From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. After a week of grim news, Americans woke up to more of it today. Investigators say it's too early to speculate on the motive of a gunman in Indianapolis who shot and killed 8 people and wounded several others at a FedEx facility last night. Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett said courage is needed in the face of yet another mass shooting.
Beyond the need of comfort for the grieving, we must guard against resignation or even despair. The assumption that this is simply how it must be, and that we might as well get used to it.
Not far from Indianapolis, the city of Chicago is also on edge. Newly released video shows a police officer chasing a 13-year-old boy named Adam Toledo down an alley and then shooting him in the chest after the boy put his hands up in the air. The confrontation was lightning fast, and police say he was carrying a gun. Yesterday, Mayor Lori Lightfoot made an emotional plea for peace.
No parent should ever have a video broadcast widely of their child's last moments. Much less be placed in the terrible situation of losing their child in the first place.
The week started with the release of police body camera video showing the death of 20-year-old Daunte Wright near Minneapolis last Sunday at the hands of a police officer who says she mistook her gun for a taser. His mother, Katie Wright, is demanding answers.
Justice isn't even a word to me. I do want accountability, 100% accountability, the highest accountability. Amen. But even then, when that happens, if that even happens, we're still going to bury our son.
And in Minneapolis, both sides in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin wrapped up testimony, and the killing of George Floyd in closing arguments will begin Monday morning. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Tolu Olorunipa is a political reporter at The Washington Post. Hi, Tolu.
Hello. Good to be here.
Yes. And Scott Wong is senior writer at The Hill. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you.
Thank you both for being here. You know, at this point, we've all seen too many mass shootings take place and too many videos showing police-involved killings. Tolu, your thoughts today and about the moment we're in a nation right now.
Well, it is definitely a time of grief, and it seems like these moments of grief have been nonstop, especially over the last year. Not only with the pandemic, but as we have seen these videos of police shootings, as well as, you know, now an increasing number of mass shootings. We have had, as a country, a normalcy when it comes to these mass shootings. It is very rare in the global community, but as Americans, we have become numb in some ways to the frequency of these mass shootings, and it seems like every week we have another instance of multiple people dying at the hands of a gunman. And in between those mass shootings, we have videos that are very visceral with the documented killings, often of minority men, by police. And it just has become almost numbing to see these things happen so regularly and to see sort of the trends of what happens from the video release to the protests to the response to the protests are often very forceful responses to the protests. And then we sort of wash, rinse, and repeat. So as a country, as a reporter, it is very difficult to see this cycle continue to repeat itself.
Scott, what about you as a reporter, as a journalist? You know, we are tasked with reporting on these, but it does take a toll.
It certainly does take a toll. And I'm thinking about how we started this year. January 6th, where I was in the Capitol and in that horrific, violent moment that sort of kicked off this year. And as Tolu has mentioned, it's just been one tragedy after another, nonstop. And I spoke to one of the Democratic leaders this week, Hakeem Jeffries, who told me it's just an incredibly heavy moment in this country, and that America is needing to confront the reality that racism has existed in this country since the very start in 1619 with slavery. And so in addition to all of those tragedies that we've seen over the past week, there was actually some movement on Capitol Hill. We saw some efforts to respond to this moment. A House committee for the first time held a historic vote on a bill to study reparations for the descendants of slaves. Over in the Senate, they advanced legislation to combat hate crimes against Asian Americans. President Biden at the White House appointed a new senior advisor, Erica Moritsugu, who will serve as his first liaison to the Asian community among all of these hate incidents against Asian Americans. And so, you know, and then to top it all off, you know, in dealing with all of this trauma, we also saw the sad images this week of the Capitol Hill community laying to rest Capitol Police Officer Billy Evans, who was killed in the line of duty. He was honored in the Capitol Rotunda this week. So it's been hard to keep up with all of this. I was standing outside the Capitol looking up at the American flag this week that was at half staff, and me and my colleague were trying to remember what incident it was lowered for, and we simply could not remember because there have been too many tragedies in recent days and weeks.
I mean, my goodness, it's almost too much, isn't it? And I think the question is, you know, what will come of any of these efforts to change anything? There's a feeling of futility that I think a lot of Americans are experiencing right now. Tolu, this week, President Biden announced that he was going to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And he spoke at the time about the 2,488 Americans who have died in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. Let's listen.
For the past 12 years, ever since I became vice president, I've carried with me a card that reminds me of the exact number of American troops killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. That exact number, not an approximation or rounded off number, because every one of those dead are sacred human beings who left behind entire families. An exact accounting of every single solitary one needs to be had.
Tolu, how do you think history will judge this decision?
Well, it was a decision that was long coming. We have been in this war for going on 20 years now, and this is something that Biden has wanted to do for quite a while. Even while he was vice president, he was against the idea of surging more troops into Afghanistan. And I think history will look upon this war as not necessarily a successful war when it comes to the goal that the United States had when we entered into this war two decades ago to vanquish the Taliban and to bring democracy to Afghanistan. The Taliban is still there, and the democracy there is very fragile and tenuous. So I think history will look on this decision as a decision that eventually had to be made because these wars cannot last forever. But it will also look at what happens after the United States leaves the country and whether or not all of the bloodshed, all of the trillions of dollars spent were worth it in the end if the Afghanistan that we leave behind is not even a fragment of the kind of Afghanistan that we thought we would leave behind when we poured thousands of troops and trillions of dollars into the country.
Well, that's exactly it, isn't it, Scott Wong? The president is facing a risk here that he pulls out U.S. troops and the Taliban moves right back in, fills the vacuum. There's another terror attack that is launched or planned from a destabilized Afghanistan. What do you think about the risk the president is facing here politically?
Yeah, and in fact, that's the exact argument that we heard from some of the key defense hawks on Capitol Hill, like Liz Cheney and Lindsey Graham, who said they were not only baffled by, you know, the decision to pull troops out, but to do it on September 11th, the very anniversary where the terrorists attacked our country two decades ago. They said it was a symbolic victory and for the Taliban that the withdrawal would happen on that specific date. You know, what we're seeing is, you know, on Capitol Hill, at least, we're seeing Democrats, for the most part, staying united behind the president's decision, just understanding that, supporting the president in saying that there really would be no great time to withdraw the troops, that after two decades of spilling American blood and treasure in this endeavor, you know, they were really, you know, it'd be very difficult to keep down this course. And in terms of Republicans, we really are seeing a divide between in the party about whether to support the president. We have heard some lawmakers support President Biden. Conservatives like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, who have been very concerned about the amount of money spent in this long war. And so, you know, we are seeing a division in the Republican Party right now.
Scott Wong is senior writer at The Hill, and Tolu Olorunipa is a political reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's this scene from an Amy Schumer sketch comedy when a cast of actresses over 40, Tina Fey, Patricia Arquette, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, are lamenting over food, how their worth in Hollywood has changed over 40.
Nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. How Sally Field was Tom Hanks's love interest in Punchline, and then like 20 minutes later she was his mom in Forrest Gump?
Well, I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
You did?
Our next guest says this would be even funnier if it weren't true. For years now, the industry has been under the microscope for its lack of diversity, not only in race and gender, but also age. Film and TV producer Amy Baer is now working to change that. She's responsible for a number of movies you might recognize, including Nancy Meyers' Something's Gotta Give. And this month, Baer is launching Landline Pictures, a Beverly Hills production company aimed at making movies for the over 50 crowd. And she joins me now. Amy, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya. Happy to be here.
You've been in this business for a while. When you look at Hollywood and its portrayal of older characters, storylines with older characters, what do you see?
I see a really interesting conundrum. Behind the cameras, the majority of people who are decision makers are over 50. And when you see movies that portray older characters as the protagonists, you almost always see a successful film. But these movies tend to become forgotten projects because everybody is chasing younger audiences or four quadrant event movies. So there's a real opportunity to capitalize on an audience that has the disposable resources, time, income, and also is habituated to really go to the movies to tell stories about their lives, about their phases of life.
That's interesting what you say about films with older characters being successful. It kind of mirrors what we see with racially diverse films doing really well. What is the disconnect in Hollywood?
You know, the reality is that advertising segments are always chasing younger demographics. And that's a function of a legacy perception from decades ago. So you are literally leaving money on the table when you're not making movies for a more diverse audience.
There are some successful examples of shows that are in production, like Grace and Frankie with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin on Netflix.
You got a computer. You don't even like the smoke detector.
I just don't think it should talk.
What possessed you to get that?
I want to be a part of the conversation.
What does that even mean?
It's like the announcer guy said last night. You Twitter, you hashtag, you Instagram. Why watch alone when I can share with millions of strangers?
And what's interesting about that television show, or that I should say that Netflix series, is that it is one of the longest running series on Netflix. You know, Netflix has a tendency to only produce between 2 and 4 seasons of any one of their series. And that's going on season 7. And that absolutely speaks to the fact that they have a very steady and robust audience for that show.
The thing about it, too, is that, for instance, my daughter and I actually watch and love this show. But I mean, who doesn't love Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin? But what actually makes, from your view, a film aimed at people specifically 50 plus, though, besides the obvious that characters are in that age range? What's the essence of one of the types of films you're hoping to make?
Well, it's a really great question. And I love that you said that you and your daughter watched that show together, because I think it gets to the heart of why these movies are almost always successful, certainly from a financial standpoint. They deal with very big universal life themes, you know, starting over, adventures, second chances. I think that that is why when you watch something like Grace and Frankie with your daughter, yes, it's about two older women whose husbands leave them, but everyone relates to starting over. That's when you're right. 18 and you graduate high school, you're starting over. When you graduate college, if you graduate college, you're starting over. When you get married, when you become a parent, when you get divorced, these are not things that happen in one segment or one moment or one decade of one's life.
Mm-hmm. This is so fascinating because, you know, I remember some years ago reading how makeup companies, for instance, choose younger models to sell makeup to older women because they feel we don't really want to see our true selves reflected. We want the fantasy. I mean, with that, do you think that not only the, as you've laid out so beautifully, the audience is there, but do you think Hollywood at large is there? Are we ready to really take this on and show a more fuller reflection of who we are on screen?
Wow, that is the essence of the issue. And I would say, as an industry, we are begrudgingly coming to terms with that, in no small part because of all of the energy around wanting to see diverse characters on screen. That diversity isn't just skin color, it isn't just sexual orientation, but it's also age. And Hollywood has a horrendous history of ageism. So I think that as an industry, we are finally coming to terms with the fact that we have to tell stories for and about everyone.
Amy, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
During these dark times, people are turning to social media to express their grief and emotions. And some of those posts have opened up larger discussions about policing, politics, and gun violence in America. Joining us now is Femi Okeh, the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, who also helps us analyze culture and conversations on social media. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Tanya.
You know, on my social feeds, people are talking about feeling less resilient or having a good cry. A lot of folks are just overwhelmed. I mean, you're seeing this kind of trauma sharing on social media, too.
There are communities in America right now, Tanya, that are living the news. So if they're not directly involved, they can see their family members, their friends, their colleagues reflected in the stories that are being reported. So there's a lot of spontaneous sharing of trauma happening online. Let me give you an example from Facebook. Latoya, who's African-American, has sent her network to her husband's Facebook page, and he's African-American as well. He lists some of the reasons he's been stopped by police. Tanya, are you ready for this? Air freshener hanging from the mirror. License tag frame. The tag frame. No front tag. Leaving a gas station. Entering a car wash. Drinking a soda. Parking next to my house. This list goes on. There are 15 items on this list. But what I've just shared with you, that's an anecdotal story. That's group sharing. Let me give you some current data to back it up. So at the end of 2020, the Pew Research Center that looks at how we consume news surveyed Black and Hispanic and white people and how they use their social feeds to discuss social issues like race. 60% of Black people use their social feeds to do this. 51% of Hispanic people use their social feeds to talk about social issues, but only 37% of white people. So there is a big difference about how people of color will be using their feeds on social.
You know, several journalists shared a clip on Monday of an anchor at WVLT 8 in Knoxville, Tennessee, who was confused about which footage the station was broadcasting because there had been two shootings on the same day.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. I forgot about the other shooting. So this is actually live. This is not our taped footage from Austin East High School earlier. The Knox County Sheriff's Office has got their helicopter back in the air because, again, we do have that other shooting investigation now underway about a mile away from the high school.
Oh, Femi, this just confusing. Speaks to the enormity of this week, right? With every passing day, there's another story somewhere in
and
America.
Today is such a good example, Tonya, or a horrible example. Trending this morning, gun control and gun reform, hashtags that are all over social right now. But what I'm also seeing this week is a growing pressure from people on social holding others to account about sharing and resharing a video of people dying or being shown in distress on camera. The best example I saw of this was just a few hours ago. Nelba Marquise Green on Twitter made a very compelling case for not sharing video. She says, when my daughter was murdered, I almost died right with her. But when the world lusted for the video and felt they owned and needed it, that was traumatizing in an equally devastating way. We should not need or consume those videos, especially without family consent. I looked up Nelba, and then I realized that her daughter was Anna Grace. She was killed in the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012. And Sandy Hook is trending also today because of the gun violence we're currently covering in the news.
Oh, you know, I'm so happy you brought up that point because it is hard for us to see, but it's even harder for those family members. You know, I go back and forth between wanting to connect on Twitter to not wanting to go on there, to staying completely away from it because it's too much. What impact is reading and scrolling through so much tragedy really having on us?
Well, this is doom scrolling, and it's just jumping from news story to bad news story to bad news story. And one of the things that's really difficult for us not to do is just to go down that rabbit hole online. And I want to leave you with a timeline cleanser. Psychologists already said this is very bad for us. We shouldn't do it. We should get offline. Yeah. And there's a little piece of advice that I got from a journalist and a writer called Celeste Headlee. And she says, get up, walk around outside for a few minutes. You know you've been staring at this screen for too long.
Femi, good advice. Thank you as always. Femi OK with The Stream and Al Jazeera English.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, like why the housing market is wild right now, what safe looks like once you're vaccinated, and how an increase in border crossings is testing the Biden administration. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
We got some positive economic news this week. Retail sales rocketed ahead last month, up nearly 10% according to the Commerce Department, as Americans put their $1,400 relief payments to work. And the economic tide is rising across the Pacific. China's economy grew 18% last quarter compared to this time last year. Let's bring in NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley for more. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you, Tanya.
Yes. So these March numbers, these March spending numbers specifically, they're the biggest in months. Did economists actually see this coming?
Economists were anticipating strong sales, but this was somewhat better than expected even. Sales were up, as you say, 9.8% last month. That's the second biggest increase on record. The only bigger one was last May when the U.S. was just coming out of the original pandemic lockdown. Some of the increase we saw last month was payback for February, when much of the country was stuck in a deep freeze and sales took a hit as a result. But even if you account for that, overall sales are way up from where they were before the pandemic. And that's important because consumer spending is a huge driver of the overall U.S. economy.
What are Americans spending the most on? What retailers or sectors specifically did best?
Last month, clothing stores did well, sporting goods stores did well, car dealers did well. The numbers kind of paint a picture of a spring awakening. You know, people who've been stuck in their houses wearing sweatpants all winter were getting outside, maybe getting new outfits, taking road trips. Restaurant sales were also up. Some of that spending reflects the $1,400 relief payments that the government began sending out in March. We've also seen a relaxation in COVID restrictions. And, of course, millions of people are getting vaccinated every day. So that means more people feel comfortable going out and spending money.
Jobless claims also dropped. They're the lowest since last March, before the worst of the pandemic. Who's hiring?
We saw a lot of hiring across the board in March. Bars and restaurants have been a good barometer of both the ups and downs over the last year, and they hired 176,000 people in March. Retailers also hired about 22,000 people. Construction companies hired 110,000 people last month. That matches a report we got this morning about a big jump in housing starts during the month. There were also a lot of jobs added in education in March as more schools reopen for in-person instruction. And that's certainly good news, not only for the kids, but also for their parents, many of whom have been unable to work or at least had challenges trying to work while their kids were at home during the school day. So as more schools reopen, more folks will be able to go back to work.
Before I let you go, I have just under a minute, but there's something else. Consumer spending has also fueled an inflation bump. The Federal Reserve says they're not worried, but just how much more expensive are goods and services getting?
We did see a jump in prices last month. They were about 0.6% compared to February and 2.6% over the last year. The numbers point to increased demand for things like haircuts and hotel rooms, which have been out of favor for most of the last year. And as demand picks up, you know, suppliers are struggling to keep up. We continue to see bottlenecks in transportation. There's a lot of cargo piling up on the West Coast. That's a recipe for higher prices. But the Federal Reserve thinks that'll work itself out and we won't see an ongoing upward spiral in prices.
NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said today that he's ready to sit down and talk with Russia. He's trying to tamp down flaring tensions at the border where Ukrainian forces have been fighting Russian-backed separatists for 7 years. In recent days, Russia has been sending troops to the region. CNN senior international correspondent Matthew Chance made a recent trip to the front lines.
I mean, we've entered this warren of trenches that have been dug along the front line. I can tell you, I mean, it's like being thrown back to the early 20th century and the Great War.
Matthew Chance joins us now from London on Skype. Matthew, welcome. I'm glad to see that you made it back safely.
It's great to be here.
You know, it seems hard to believe that there's this war going on in 2021 that looks like a conflict from Europe more than 100 years ago. Tell us what you saw in eastern Ukraine.
I was just as astonished as anyone else. Getting there to the front line and walking through those sort of hand-dug, muddy trenches, you know, with people boiling pots of hot tea on sort of stoves in tunnels that they've dug out. You played that little clip of me then, and you noticed my voice went down because as soon as I started talking, people turned around and went, stop talking, you know, shush, because it's so dangerous there. You know, they've had 20 people shot by snipers across no man's land this year alone. That's not a lot compared to the number of people that have died in this conflict since it began 7 years ago. It just gives you a sense that this is a dangerous stalemate.
Well, and it's back in the news because Russian troops have been massing on the border. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he believes that Russia is getting ready to invade his country. Can you explain actually what is going on right now? Why ratchet up these tensions now?
Yeah. It's a good question. Unfortunately, one without a definite answer, because we don't really know what the Russians are playing at. What they say is that these are just military exercises. They're not a threat to anyone, is what they say. But at the same time, they've got more troops now on the border of Ukraine than any time in the past 7 or 8 years. So we've got upwards of about 50,000 new forces. I think what the Russians are doing is operating on a couple of levels. On the one hand, they're sort of sending a message to the Ukrainians, don't try and retake the territory that's held by the rebels that we back, otherwise we'll send in our forces strongly. They want to test the resolve of Joe Biden. They're concerned about how close Ukraine is moving towards NATO. The Russians are fundamentally opposed to that. They would be absolutely furious if it happened, And actually, it would probably provoke a, you know, an unapologetic response from Moscow.
Well, in fact, you asked President Zelensky this in the trenches there on the front lines. You asked him whether or not joining NATO would antagonize Russia even further. And here's his answer.
Maybe you are right, but what our people do here, they fight. So we have independent country and we decide where to be or where not to be.
So to be or not to be, quoting Shakespeare there. What did he mean exactly? And what would joining NATO mean for Ukraine?
Actually, I thought it was, you know, a little bit disingenuous what he was saying. He was like, well, we're fighting now. If we join NATO, we're still going to be fighting. But of course, it wouldn't just be Ukraine fighting the rebels. And so it would be highly dangerous, I think, for NATO to get into a direct confrontation with Russia, which is why, unfortunately for Ukraine, I don't think the argument is going to go its way when it comes to NATO membership. What they probably are going to get, though, is more weapons. They're going to get more money to prosecute this war, and they're going to be this, what they are now, which is a sort of buffer state, I suppose, where the Russians and NATO, you know, fight it out against each other through Ukraine.
You had said that Vladimir Putin might be testing the resolve of the new American president, Joe Biden. What about that? And now that Biden has proposed this summit with President Putin this summer, did he get Biden to blink here? What's the analysis there on the Americans' response to this?
You have seen Washington sit up and take notice of a conflict that had pretty much disappeared off the radar in terms of its importance geopolitically and the attention it was getting around the world. And of course, one of Putin's big aspirations, one of his big ambitions, is to be considered as being a top player at the top table of international diplomacy. It's what he always wants to show his people. And so he wants nothing more than a one-on-one sort of Cold War style summit with the US president. And he's got that. But it's not come, you know, cost-free. You know, there's been a raft of new sanctions that the United States has imposed against Russia over the past couple of days. And it was only a couple of weeks ago, remember, that Joe Biden called Putin a killer or agreed with the statement, is he a killer? And that really upset the Kremlin. They don't like being sort of verbally abused in that way by their counterparts elsewhere.
CNN senior international correspondent Matthew Chance, we're going to link to his reporting from the trenches in eastern Ukraine at hereandnow.org. Matthew, there's this moment when you are dashing for cover with President Zelensky there at the front lines because it's so dangerous. It's a remarkable report. We encourage people to watch it. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
The Biden administration is expected to make a big promise next week to dramatically cut America's greenhouse gas emissions over the next 10 years. Scientists say it will take a long time for the atmosphere to show the benefits, but the cuts are crucial if humans hope to avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports on this story that first aired on All Things Considered.
Last week, the Earth hit a new record for the concentration of carbon dioxide up in the atmosphere. 420 parts per million. To put that in perspective, humans are now halfway to doubling the amount of CO2 up there, which is why hurricanes and heat waves, wildfires and droughts are all getting more severe.
The reason we have a problem right now is because we are pumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than natural systems can absorb.
Solomon Chung is a climate scientist at Berkeley. CO2 and other greenhouse gases come out of tailpipes and smokestacks. They drift up into the air, mixing with oxygen and nitrogen and water vapor. And then they just stay there, trapping heat from the sun.
Greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, spend a long time in the atmosphere.
Here's the thing about carbon dioxide. It is not a gas that particularly likes playing with other gases. It's pretty stable. So once it's in the atmosphere, it stays in the atmosphere until it's reabsorbed by something down on Earth, like the ocean or a tree or a rock, which can take a long time.
If you want to get rid of the CO2 in the atmosphere, we're talking thousands of years.
James Butler leads greenhouse gas monitoring for one of the federal government's big atmospheric science labs.
As we start to reduce the CO2 emissions, say we cut them off, there would still be a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, and that will continue to warm the planet.
It's not just CO2. Another greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide, takes about a century to break down. Methane, which mostly comes from agriculture and oil and gas wells, is a funny one. It's extremely good at trapping heat, much better than CO2, but it's way less stable, so it breaks down after about 10 years. But when it breaks down, methane can turn into CO2. This is why greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere over time, and why, even if the U.S. were to dramatically reduce emissions immediately, it would take a little while for the atmosphere to catch up.
So it's kind of like you're driving a giant train. It's very heavy. You slam on the brakes. The train keeps going for a while. So there is some amount of heating that we would continue to experience.
Xiang says cutting emissions as much as possible, as quickly as possible, is absolutely crucial. It will make the world a lot safer for people who are in kindergarten right now. But if humanity is a train that's about to hit its brakes, then it's important to remember that the train is headed for a cliff. And the people who are at the front of this train are those who are most vulnerable to rising seas, more severe heat waves, flooding, and droughts.
Those are the people that actually get sent off the cliff, right? They're the ones who really are harmed because we didn't stop the train fast enough. Doesn't mean everyone goes off the cliff, but it does mean, you know, that those people on the front lines, they're going to continue to bear the brunt of climate change for the next several decades.
Around the world, the people on the front lines are more likely to be poor people. It's why cutting greenhouse gas emissions won't be enough on its own. Countries like the U.S. will need to help pay for the costs of adaptation. Because no matter what, it's going to be a dangerously hot century for a lot of people. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
For the next week, Here Now is participating in a global journalism collaboration to strengthen coverage of climate change. The series is called Covering Climate Now, and today's story looks at offshore wind. The Biden administration wants to expand the renewable energy, pledging to create tens of thousands of jobs and help us meet our climate goals. Any day now, the federal government will issue a ruling on the first commercial-scale project off the coast of Massachusetts. It's a decision that could pave the way for dozens of other projects up and down the Atlantic coast. Miriam Wasser from member station WBUR has the story.
It is a windy day in the port city of New Bedford, about 60 miles south of Boston. And here at the Marine Commerce Terminal, a big, open, concrete area right on the harbor, there's not much going on. But this is where Bruce Carlisle wants you to use your imagination.
In my mind's eye, I see the tower sections stacked and lined up. I see the blades all ready to go. I see forklifts and cranes and crawlers and just all sorts of activity.
Carlisle is in charge of everything offshore wind at the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, better known as MassCEC. MassCEC is helping the state prepare the workforce and infrastructure it needs for the green energy future. And a little over a decade ago, it bet big on offshore wind and built the 29-acre Marine Commerce Terminal. To date, it remains the only offshore wind staging ground in the country, specifically designed to withstand the incredible amount of weight required to partially assemble huge wind turbines.
We've known for a while that offshore wind presents a significant renewable energy resource, and it was really only a matter of time.
Except offshore wind never was a sure thing in the U.S. Years before the terminal was complete, the country's first proposed offshore wind farm, Cape Wind, off the coast of Cape Cod, was already beset by concerns about how the turbines would affect ocean views. The project fizzled about 7 or 8 years ago, and so too did talk about a big offshore wind revolution on the East Coast.
We followed what was happening with Cape Wind, and we were sort of curiously looking at would there ever be a project here in the U.S.?
Lars Peterson is the CEO of Vineyard Wind. He says his company finally saw an opportunity to jump into the U.S. market in 2016. That's when Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker signed a law saying that utility companies in the state need to start buying power from offshore wind within a decade. Vineyard Wind is now slated to become the first large-scale offshore wind farm in the country. It'll be located about 12 miles off of Martha's Vineyard and should produce enough electricity to power 400,000 homes in Massachusetts every year.
I would call it a once-in-a-generation opportunity to build a new industry, develop the workforce, creating manufacturing construction sites, and also deliver clean, affordable energy.
The company submitted their project plans to the federal government for approval in 2017 and several other states and companies quickly followed. The review process for Vineyard Wind was supposed to take 2 years, but in August 2019, the Trump administration did something unexpected. It put the project on hold. Officials said they wanted to take a step back and examine the cumulative impacts of a big offshore wind industry. But the move threatened to upend Vineyard Wind's project supply chain, financing, and construction plan. And it raised significant questions about the future of the project.
But it is a new day under the Biden administration.
This was U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm in March.
I recognize that over the past few years, the federal government's approach to offshore wind has probably seemed like a chicken with its head cut off, no direction, no consistency.
This was all about to change, Granholm said. The Biden administration has promised to jumpstart the wind industry by speeding up the review process, opening new lease areas, and helping to create tens of thousands of union jobs. It's an ambitious goal, for sure, but not everyone is thrilled.
They play it down like there's no effect on the ecosystem. I can't see how it can't when you start putting hundreds and hundreds of these poles in the water.
Peter Anthony has been in the fishing industry in New Bedford for 40 years. I caught him on the phone recently while he was out on the dock.
We've been here forever. The fishing communities have been fishing these areas because they're fertile fishing areas.
He says many fishermen have felt blindsided by the federal government's support for offshore wind. And while wind companies have made some accommodations, like increasing the space between turbines in the water, he still feels like it's all moving too quickly, and that the country has decided to trade one renewable resource, seafood, for another, wind energy. The federal government will issue a decision soon on Vineyard Wind's proposal. And if it's approved, the company says it could start offshore construction next year and deliver power by the end of 2023.
I'm sure they'll be drinking champagne and pumping their fists and they'll be all happy about it. But I think in the fishing community, yeah, they're going to look at it as a loss.
We'll find a way to celebrate, that's for sure.
Lars Peterson of Vineyard Wind is optimistic about the coming decision.
When you just look at the fundamentals for this industry, the strong winds, the shallow water, the amount of people living along the coastline, the state's ambitions of going towards a net zero target, there's no way you don't have offshore wind as part of that equation.
Peterson says he knows some fishermen are not happy, but he feels that the two industries can coexist. And in his mind, the project his team has proposed and that the federal government seems likely to approve is an example of that. For Here and Now, I'm Miriam Wasser.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.